Drop three. How did you get on in your own bomb dropping tests before you became an instructor?
Well, naturally, I was, as you know from the records, I was successful, but one or two incidents might be interesting. For instance, on the one occasion, we were supposed to drop bombs at 1,000 feet when we enveloped in cloud. Two or three times the pilot went round and tried to find the target, but we just couldn't. And we felt we'd have to give up this project altogether and land. But fortunately, we went round again and about 100 feet, saw the target, and I naturally dropped the bombs from 100 feet, which, much to my surprise and quite frankly our joy, that they counted as being dropped from 1,000 feet. Because on previous occasion I was told I was to do what I was told and not to think when I said I wouldn't drop bombs because the visibility wasn't too good. So on this occasion I thought I'd drop the bombs, and so therefore I perhaps had the advantage of this particular incident that I dropped from 100 feet instead of 1,000.
Who determined whether the visibility was good enough for practice or not?
Whoever was in charge of the school, for instance. I did, of course, in the when I was made a staff gun there to take other people through, just the visibility every time before we started any lessons or any instruction with a pilot. And one particular man often went with Lieutenant Arnold. He went with him more times than the others.
There was no official or as far as you knew weather officer.
Oh no. No, we had these Timmy left to the pilot and myself, of course, to say yes, it's visibility's quite good. It's good enough for me. If I found the visibility good enough for myself, well, it should be good enough for everybody else. It's as simple as that.
What types of aircraft were you flying during the East Church?
The Morris Farman, mostly. Which, of course, as you know, was made of bamboo and wire with a small 6-inch piece of board for a seat. The wires, of course, control wires, more is coming back of each side of your head when you're sitting in the back of the pilot. And otherwise, they're quite safe. Only one engine, of course, and one propeller.
But, how did you... want a better expression, approach the bomb site? I mean, did you sit over the bomb site or did you lie prone looking through it? Or?
Well, at first, because you sat in the ordinary way, there's this toggle you see. But and the actual bomb in the early pages, invariably you just lay down in a prone position. But it's more comfortable, of course, and it's the only way you could do it, really, because. The angle of the bomb sight had to go through the bottom of the plane, the cockpit, and the cockpit. And also the lever, as it were, for the toggle, to release these 14 bombs, if you had 14 bombs on, would such you get more power that way.
What rank were you before and after passing as an instructor?
Just the same gun layer, gun layer mechanic. And it wasn't until I went to France, of course, and became a sergeant observer then, you see. I wanted to be sergeant observer.
This is might seem rather sort of peculiar question, but how was the grass kept short at East Church?
Well, as far as I remember, we had sheep at one time, but then, of course, the speed of the machines themselves, I mean, going over the ground time after time, and soon the grass didn't have much opportunity of growing, really. But we did have sheep at times there, but it wasn't necessary because the runways were such, as I say, that the machines themselves kept it short, you see.
Was East Church, do you think, a happy station?
Well, in my opinion, yes, very, very happy indeed, because everybody had one object in view, and that was to be trained and keen, and you've got to remember, too, of course, as I recollect, that every man is a fit man, and if you get healthy, fit people, well, you're generally happy people. That's in my personal opinion, but that's what had happened as far as these shirts were concerned. Obviously, every man there was a perfectly fit man, otherwise he wouldn't be called upon to or chosen for that particular work.
How did you come to leave East Church in August 1917?
In September, I think it was, we left, actually. But I made a request that I wanted to do beyond active service, more or less, a foreign service. And again, the request wasn't granted immediately, but finally they did agree that I should go out to the East Mediterranean. I was fitted out for this and inoculated. And I waited and waited, and I waited for a month, and I really began to get again very disturbed about the whole thing. But ever after that a month, I was then switched from the Mediterranean to France, and went out to a place called Cudikirk, this is the other side of Calais. They joined in the 207 squadron of Henley Pages.
Was it then called 207 squadron?
Yes, it's number 7 squadron. Then, because it wasn't renumbered until April the 1st, 1918, when the RAF was formed. And I think I'm right in saying that all naval squadrons had 200 placed before their number, and all naval personnel had 20,000 placed before their numbers. I think I'll find you're right. Well, the RAFC retained their original number of their squadron and of their personnel.
When going across the channel, did you have to travel in a sort of army ferry transport, or did you? I've heard that some people are able to go in the local duty destroyer.
Well, we travelled to London and on to Dover, but I don't quite remember what we went on that occasion. But it was just ordinary, as far as I remember, ordinary cross channel boat. That's all. There's a bit of transport, obviously, you see, at Dover. And we just landed at Kelly, you see.
Were you, as far as you know, going to be replacements for casualties, or were they building up the squadron?
Well, it's both. It so happened I was a replacement, because I think that Commander Brackley, I went with, who was then squadron leader, he lost his observer. And I was fortunate enough to be chosen for as his observer again, which happened a little delay in being appointed to a machine, but fortunately Jack Keane and myself, in a few well a short while, we were appointed to two machines. I had fortunately, sort of leader Brackley, who became our commander finally, and I stopped with him practically all the way through until he was made commander of the squadron. But the same as I am with that particular machine, I think it's HP-3130, I flew practically all the time until we lost it at a place called Newport, more or less no man's land, as brought down there.
I would gather that Brackley would play quite an important part in your story of the squadron. What sort of person was he?
I really find it difficult to describe him, really. He's one of the nicest men I wish to meet. He wasn't flamboyant in any way, very, very quiet, very unassuming, extremely fit man, a wonderful swimmer, I remember, and so keen on all kinds of fitness tests and so forth, and at the same time, very fine leader and commander, and he expected all of us to give what he showed could be done. He led the way in all things. If we were moving from one aerodrome to another, which we did on one or two occasions, he would always lead the squadron. He would always show the way. And any special particular bombing to be done, as you know from my records, he chosen to go to a place called Namur Bridge, which, according to the army, had to be smashed before they could make any great advance. Brackley himself was a pilot on that occasion. Also Captain Paul Bucher, who was also a reporter afterwards of the Daily Mail, and myself. But again, there's a case in point that Brackley took the lead and did that particular work himself. And we were, on that occasion, we were successful, as the records prove.
Um, When you arrived at... when you arrived at Coudekerk, what sort of welcome awaited you there?
Well, I don't know what you mean by welcome exactly. The usual naval welcome, you know, but we sailed from Dover on adventure ship Brighton. And enjoyed the crossing very immensely and landed at Calais. And here again a hitch occurred regarding transport. I must say here that the Royal Naval Air Service were classed more or less as nobody's children, and really, although we're naval, so the army had no jurisdiction over us. We sent a message to Dunkirk, asking for a car to be sent, and we had to wait. And during this intervening time, we were toured around Calais. We had tea, and they certainly seemed to make enough from tea and profit and so on. At 6 p.m., our car from Dunkirk arrived and paid us at last. We arrived at Dunkirk about 9 p.m., and here I met several of my old friends from Felixstowe. They soon made my friend Jack Keane and myself very comfortable for the night, and news from all sides were exchanged before retiring, which once again was nearly 1 a.m. before we fell asleep. Next morning, about 10 a.m., August the 4th, we left for Coudekerk, the final stages of our journey, which lasted about an hour. After the usual questions, medical examinations and formalities, we were duly enrolled to the complement of No. 7 Squadron, No. 5 Wing, Royal Naval Air Service. During the week following, we were given all kinds of work to do. We did everything except what we were sent for, namely flying. And after 5 days, we found this very humiliating, so we decided to put in a request to see the officer in charge of armaments, Lieutenant Wayne. This was granted, and the next day we had the interview. We told him we would like to go to a squadron where they wouldn't have needed gun layers. He at once replied, "If we want you here, and in due course you will have a machine." After a little more conversation, we left with the consolation that one day we might be needed. The next day, to our joy, Jack Keenan and myself were allocated a machine each. This is on August 11th, 7 days after our arrival.
This was a Hanley Page?
Hanley Page, yes. My number, the Hanley Page, was number 3130, and the pilot was Flight Commander H. Brackley.
Was this the largest type of aircraft you'd been involved with?
Yes, oh yes, yes, yes. I had no experience before of such a machine, of course, before being, let's say, one flight on the seaplane, the Curtiss, and also the Morris Farman, which is a different type of machine altogether, of course. These machines, of course, you realise, were 2,400 horsepower Rolls-Royce engines. And where I think, I'm not sure the weight, but I got my ideas about 20 tonnes.
What was the impression when you were in one of these, that this thing is too big to get off the ground, or did it seem absolutely secure?
Absolutely secure. It was like a dreadnought, more or less, as I can describe it. And one felt absolutely confident that the Germans or anybody else could never bring it down. I mean, whatever you did, I mean, the only way to bring it down was to hit it direct with another machine, as far as we could feel. But because we were brought down, as one of our raids, we got hit over Bruges at about 10,000 feet. And finally got brought down, and in Morris and No Man's Land, we were very fortunate. We tried to make the coast, actually, but the wind was against us, and we drifted. We only had one engine from Bruges, so we more or less glided down all the way to Newport, which is No Man's Land. But fortunately, we got away, got out. We tried to save what we could of the machine, but after about 5 minutes, the Belgians came out and saved us. And as soon as daylight came, or daybreak, the Germans just blew it to pieces. I mean, they just fired everything. They got the whole machine disintegrated and went. But another peculiar incident, a funny incident from that, our armaments officer is in charge of all, naturally, all the guns and bombs and so forth. He's a responsible position. He really was very cross because we lost the five Lewis guns on the machine. and almost threatened to court martial us because we didn't save the guns. And I asked him then if he thought we were going to put 5 loose guns up my waistcoat in no man's land. But what we did save, of course, was I saved the maps, what we had, and brought back our own revolvers, the Webley Mark IV. That's about all we did bring back of armaments. But an armament officer was very upset because we lost the guns.
Do you think the guns were destroyed or that they might have been quietly acquired by the nearest infantry unit?
Well, I think they're destroyed, really. The Germans absolutely shelled up the machine to pieces, absolutely. Shell after shell, they put the whole thing went up in Morrison. Small pieces, you could see it all flying through the air.
It didn't catch fire?
No. Oh, no, I think we had enough petrol to catch fire anyway. I shouldn't think so.
You'd been hit in the engine?
No, we'd been hit in the propeller, actually, and the water jet, I think the radiator went. Mm. The propeller stopped, you see, over Bruges. So we only had one engine, so we couldn't fire the other one, because the one engine was racing away if we kept it. Mm. No good running the other one, because it would have gone running in circles like a spiral down. That's no good, so we had to throttle down the other one and make it more as a glider of it. Mm-hmm. So, because naturally enough, the searchlights just picked us up one for the other and carried us over from one to the other. Not only searchlights, but everything I think possible they could fire at us, they did. In fact, I got an idea they're throwing almost pea shooters at the finish. They're throwing everything at us, really, but it didn't bring us down.